Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today is January 19th, 2024. We're back from our winter break, and we're talking with Itamar Lerner. Itamar is assistant professor of psychology here at UTSA. He studies memory and altered learning states, including psychiatric disorders and PTSD, and especially in regard to sleep and sleep disorders. He uses experimental methods, doing experiments with human subjects to study these things, and he combines his experiments with computational modeling. Hi, Itamar.
Hi.
And I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So, Itamar, everybody knows that sleep is important for learning. And most of us have heard this story that short-term memories are consolidated into long-term memories during slow-wave sleep. And then, in my simple way of thinking, that would predict that if I missed a night of sleep, I would forget a day of activity. But that definitely doesn't happen. You can miss several nights of sleep and still remember at least some things about what happened in the meantime. So there must be something wrong with that very simple story. So I wonder if you could begin by giving us a more, scientifically accurate view of the role of sleep in learning in general, and then we'll talk about details.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first answer would be that nobody really knows why we sleep, and that simple theory that you mentioned is kind of like a scaffolding for theories which have some more details, but I don't think there is a very clear answer of how much sleep contributes to memory consolidation and what can we remember without sleep. You can't really take a person and let them function in the world without 2 weeks of sleep, right? and see what happens. I would say that the main term here is memory consolidation. So the initial encoding does occur anyway. And the transformation of short-term memory, or working memory, or it's not exactly short-term memory. It's basically memory of your experiences that is, consolidated or encoded in the hippocampus and needs to be moved to the general knowledge structure in the cortex. That could happen also during times of rest. It doesn't have to be sleep. But in any case, the transformation is not the thing that allows you to remember versus not to remember. It allows you to remember better. It allows you to remember the important things and maybe actually forget the less important things. So I would say that the main contribution would be of this consolidation procedure is to reorganize memory and maybe shape it in a way that will be more useful for you in the future rather than just memorization per se. So that's one answer. The other is that this active consolidation hypothesis, which is what you referred to in that simple version that you mentioned, is not the only game in town. There is another, I would say, competing, but doesn't necessarily have to be competing, theory, which is the synaptic homeostasis theory coming from Tononi and Cirelli. And they suggest that what happens during sleep, particularly slow sleep, is actually a little different. They suggest that what happens during wake, when you are active in the world and learning, there is a net increase in the synaptic strength between neurons, and that net increase puts you in some danger for eventually reaching a place where you're in risk for epileptic seizures, maybe, right? Because it's too much, too intensified, right? All these synaptic weights, and you need to reduce rescale the strength of those synaptic weights. And that happens during sleep, according to that theory. So what happens is that you learned all kinds of things, and so the synaptic waves got this specific strength with very particular relative strengths to each other. And what happens during slow sleep is that there is rescaling. So the relative strength is kind of preserved, but it's all rescaled during sleep. And that is the main function of sleep, according to this theory, not necessarily the transfer of information from the hippocampus to the neocortex.
So in that theory, what would we expect to see experimentally in people that were tested for memory with and without sleep.
So you would expect to some degree more capacity in the hippocampus to get to more information, to encode new information, because once the rescaling has happened, then the hippocampus is kind of like reset and ready to go. While if it's like too much potentiated, right, the synaptic weights are too strong, then you don't have enough room to learn new things. That's one thing. And you would maybe expect even synaptic seizures if somebody, or like seizures in general, if somebody's not sleeping for a considerable amount of time.
But even for a short time, you might think that the ability to acquire new memories would deteriorate over time without sleep. And I think there's something like that that really happens.
Right. If you're like sleep deprived, like if you just write the tongue, don't sleep for, I don't know, 24 hours, 36 hours, you will find yourself incapacitated in many aspects. So that could potentially be related to the synaptic homeostasis theory,
So one part of that simple story is slow-wave sleep, specifically slow-wave sleep. But slow-wave sleep is only a portion of sleep. There's also REM sleep. And is it the case that REM sleep has no responsibilities at all in this process?
Yeah, obviously REM has a lot of responsibilities, but I would think it's fair to say that REM sleep, although it was considered to be the most interesting or maybe even important part of sleep in the past, it was more difficult to attribute a very particular role for REM sleep, because slow wave sleep has all kind of these metrics, particular metrics when you measure EEG signals on the scalp and other measurements that may be more easy to interpret. For example, the fact that the hippocampus sends a lot of information to the neocortex during slow sleep, this is something that can be seen physiologically, and there is no such very, very, very clear high-level changes in communication between brain areas in REM sleep, at least not to that level. So that's one thing.
So this is the kind of thing you see with functional imaging, like connectivity measures or something like that?
Actually, even with animal studies, you can see it, and you can measure, I think that the levels of secretion of certain neurotransmitters and synaptic clefts and so on and so forth. There's several ways of measuring it. I wouldn't say necessarily that's based on MRI. That's based, I think, on animal work. So in REM sleep, it's not as easy to find such clear high-level changes. And also, I would say that REM sleep, being closer to wake in terms of how the EEG looks like, they don't have very clear occurrences like things like sleep spindles and K-complexes that happen during non-REM sleep that are more easily identified, and therefore they can be associated to certain behavioral changes that happen following sleep. But there is no question among everybody that REM sleep is extremely important. It's just more difficult to find out what exactly that it does. And also, at some point it was found out that the first thing that happens when you go to sleep is slow of sleep or non-REM sleep in general. So that also contributes to the idea that maybe this is the more fundamental thing that we need for...
It has a high priority. We make sure we get that done before the end.
That's right. That's right. And only once this is done, you get REM sleep for whatever it's doing as a bonus. I'm you know, joking, of course, but because REM sleep is very fundamental as well.
It goes through cycles. So
that's right.
Does that make any sense? I mean, why do we cycle between REM and
sleep? That is also a big open question. I have my own theories, and I just recently read a computational model that suggests another theory, but those are not very established theories. This is an open question. Why do you need this fluctuation? And if really there is a meaning to having a little N2 sleep and a little slower sleep and then some REM and then go back and so on and so forth, it might be, but it's still an open question.
So does it matter what kind of thing is being remembered? So, one of the ways we go wrong, I think, is that we get a model of some kind of this is our model of memory, and we just study it and study it and study it, and we think, well, now we're studying every kind of memory. But it often turns out that it's not true.
Right. So for quite some time, it was found that certain types of cognitive functions seem to benefit mostly from certain sleep stages. So, for example, memory consolidation and detection and abstraction of patterns was often found to be related to non-REM sleep and to slower sleep in particular. While different types of cognitive functions, for example, emotional regulation and emotional processing in general, almost always, if you find any relation to a particular sleep stage at all, is found to be related to REM sleep. At the same time, REM sleep was also shown to be related to certain motor activity and motor benefits that sleep allows for, and also for things like creativity, certain types of creativity at least. So it's hard to, you know, connect all those together. Why would REM sleep benefit both certain motor activities and creativity and emotional regulation? But the fact is that there is definitely associations between REM sleep and these types of cognitive functions and non-REM sleep more related to memory consolidation in general.
And with any kind of learning that we do, there are different aspects of it. So I listen to a lot of people talking about animal learning experiments, and they are fascinated by the differences between acquisition and recall and extinction and all of these phenomena that are associated with learning, and they usually have slightly different brain mechanisms. And is that kind of distinction made in sleep? Like, sleep affects extinction more than acquisition, or vice versa, or something like that.
So are you talking in relation to emotional processing or in general?
Oh, well, take your pick.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about emotion regulation. So many studies suggest that REM sleep does have an influence both on acquisition of fear memories, for example, when you experience a fearful event and or a threat, and sleep can modulate the way that you recall this event later on and generalize it to similar events. So sleep, and particularly REM sleep, was shown to often increase fear recall after experiencing such event, but also increase fear extinction. The ability to kind of like forget that threatening event after it's no longer relevant. All of those were related to certain brain areas that are known to be contributing to the acquisition of fearful memories and to stress in general. First of all, the amygdala, which is the often referred to as the fear center of the brain. That's probably where the first associations between a certain event, certain occurrence, and threatening feeling or stress is made. And then the ventromedial prefrontal cortex that regulates the amygdala and also contributes to extinction if the threat is no longer relevant. And the hippocampus that gives context to the experience. So those three areas are all known to contribute to the encoding of stressful experiences, and they were all shown to be modulated by REM sleep.
So they're all working together in the same at the same time. So both extinction and acquisition, and I guess during recall involves, I don't know, a memory that was stored in the amygdala that has to be suppressed or enhanced by the inputs from the hippocampus.
Emotional memories, then the idea is that a recall of a fearful memory, of a threatening memory, involves the hippocampus and the amygdala. The hippocampus with a context, okay, that threatening experience happened to me in this and that room, in this and that environment, and the amygdala is creating this association between these events or particular elements in the events and the expression of fear. And the ventromedial prefrontal cortex is considered to modulate the amygdala. So it allows the amygdala to go on and encode the event, but then it can send inhibitory signals to the amygdala and reduce this fear, this association between certain occurrence and the feeling of stress if it's no longer relevant. Specifically, it's known that when you experience the fearful event and you extinct it, you didn't forget it. The association is still there in the amygdala, but the ventromedial prefrontal cortex inhibits it. Right. So, for example, in a classic conditioning experiment, if you get an electric shock every time that you see this chair, and eventually you get it, right? The association is created, so you can see the chair and starts to feel fearful even if you don't get the shock anymore. Then this association was created in the amygdala, but then if you see the chair 10 more times and don't get shock, you'll start to show signs of extinction, right? This kind of a reduction of fear from seeing the chair, but this is not because the original association in the amygdala disappeared, it's because the ventromedial prefrontal cortex inhibited it. And so, and that's true unrelated to sleep. With sleep, particularly REM sleep, there are indications that the more REM sleep you have, the stronger is the creation of the original association, but also the quicker the extinction takes place.
So in a, I know in our experiments we purposely simplify everything as much as we can, mm-hmm. so, because we need to.
Right.
But in real life situations, context can often be really complicated.
Yeah.
So something bad happens to me if this and that and the other thing, but not this other thing. And really to understand the situation that's bothering me, I have to have a theory of all those relationships and establish that theory so that I can predict correctly what's going to be unpleasant in the future.
Yeah.
And in real life for us, it can become extremely complicated to the point where we can't sort it out and we start reacting to things that are irrelevant. So where is that happening? Where is this like model of the world?
Right.
I mean, so, maybe that's too hard. Is that too hard of a question?
No, that's actually really relates to the idea about REM sleep. So there is, the way that current theories look at that is that the amygdala, where those threat associations are created, is aided by this structure called the locus coeruleus that secretes norepinephrine to the amygdala, kind of give it as a signal of something very important is happening, you should encode it.
But it's something in time. It's not something in space, or it's just saying, right, this moment.
There's a moment, that's right. There's a phasic burst of norepinephrine that the locus coeruleus secretes due to, you know, the realization of whatever, maybe it's very salient in the environment. These are the things that the locus coeruleus may recognize and kind of tells the amygdala, you should encode it. And when that thing happens, the association is created, but it does seem there is evidence to suggest that norepinephrine levels increase during wake time. And they increase to the point, kind of like is a little resembling what I mentioned before in relation to the sleep homeostasis hypothesis, the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis. So also at the level of the norepinephrine in the system, if it accumulates during wake, then at some point the amygdala might become too sensitive and starts to encode many things, maybe if they're not very salient or not very threatening. And so you won't have this selective effect where you're really responding to the fearful dog that you've just seen, but you're not responding to another dog that looks a little bit the same, like this threatening dog, but is actually kind of innocent. And one theory that relates to how REM sleep contributes to solve this problem is the REM recalibration hypothesis by Walker and Goldston from 2014. And it's based on the finding that during REM sleep, there is a cessation of input coming from the locus coeruleus to the amygdala. That could potentially suggest that it allows the neural the levels of norepinephrine in the system to reduce and maybe get back to what I would say normal levels, such that the amygdala is no longer too sensitive and can become more selective again to actual threatening experiences. So with enough REM sleep, yes, you may have seen a fearful dog, and you may have start to extend this or generalize this experience to other dogs and maybe also to innocent dogs that are not really posing any threat, unneeded in a way that is not useful. But then when the norepinephrine levels reduce during REM sleep, then you're becoming tuned again. And so the generalization will extend to actual dogs that seem that resemble this fearful dog that you experience sufficiently, and not to innocent dogs that only superficially resemble the threatening dog, but not really. And so REM sleep in that case is needed to do this fine tuning of the connections in the amygdala to be able to extend only to relevant stimuli. Here the hippocampus is also playing part, because the hippocampus is probably the first place where some of those generalizations occur. More sophisticated generalizations probably happen in the cortex, but some basic generalizations happen in the hippocampus already, and it is involving, I mentioned that it's contributing to the context, right? So it also contributes to extending your experience to similar contexts. So I was in this room and I had a very, very terrible experience, not the podcast, right? Not something else. And then I'm going to another very similar room and there's another person that looks like you, and I know that I'm going to do something else that is similar. I should be afraid of it. But if I'm going to this room and without so many other threatening cues, I don't see you, I don't see other situation that contributed to some fearful experience originally, then I shouldn't extend this threat, this feeling of threat. So the hippocampus is really involved in this. And if there is too much sensitivity in the amygdala, then it could cause the hippocampus to generalize too much. And if we reduce the norepinephrine levels, then the things are recalibrated better, such that there won't be such overgeneralization.
This seems to offer kind of an explanation for some of the psychiatric things you study.
That's correct, yeah.
Like, it sounds like a good way to develop a phobia of dogs is to not have enough, is to have too much generalization in your response to some dog.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And what other things are like that?
Yeah, and moreover, some theories of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD think that this, to some degree, is a disease of overgeneralization. Common examples are that, you know, a veteran comes back from war, experience some kind of a bomb going off near them, and then they're starting to be afraid of all big noises. A woman was raped, and then she starts to be afraid of all men. These instances are examples of overgeneralization, where a specific threatening experience starts to make you feel threatened and fearful in inappropriate settings, right? In settings which you shouldn't generalize to. You should be fearful of anything that might actually go off as a bomb, right? So yeah. If you've got other cues which are very predictable or highly predictive of a bomb about to take off, then you should generalize your previous experience. But you shouldn't to every big bang, right? So it seems to be very important for this hippocampus and amygdala and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex involvement to really be tuned to the really most predictable or predictive threat cues, and not to cues which actually signal safety or don't signal anything at all.
So our whole life, we are refining our view of what can lead to something good and what can lead to something bad, and building us increasingly more sophisticated and discerning model of the world. Yep. We rely on REM sleep to keep that running?
To some degree, to some degree. So, well, again, we're talking about theories, so I wouldn't say that there is a clear answer. And I'm sorry that this is kind of a repeating pattern, but I think that as a scientist, we should also be humble and not overplay our hands or our evidence.
Agreed.
But yes, REM sleep seems to be involved in this processing. And specifically, recent studies of mine actually show that the degree of predictability of the predictiveness, right, of certain cues in environments which are multifaceted and complex, they don't have only just threatening cues, only just safety cues, but combine both, that it seems that REM sleep makes us more tuned to be especially fearful of the most predictable cues the cues that are most predictive of threat, and to be less predictive or less sensitive to cues that are not that predictive. You can think about it as, let's say that you are experiencing some kind of threat or a fearful experience environment which holds these different cues with different predictive values, then you can think about some kind of a function of how much you would be sensitive to these various cues based on their predictability, and this may be some kind of like a gradient. And what sleep, or particularly REM sleep, would do is sharpen this curve such that you will be more fearful of the most predictive cues and less fearful of the less predictive cues. While without REM sleep, if you don't have enough REM sleep, then it's a little more blurry, it's not as sharp, it's not as tuned, and that could lead you to overgeneralize, to be afraid of the not that predictive cues, and maybe not sufficiently wary of the most predictive cues.
So possibly some of the like psychiatric problems that people have are related to not getting enough or the good enough REM sleep.
Yep.
If my REM sleep isn't good, what can I do? Is there something?
So, yeah, I would say, so first of all, I would say that whether we're talking about pre-existing sleep patterns that you have. For example, you don't get a lot of REM sleep because, I don't know, you're predisposed genetically to not getting enough REM sleep, or because of life habits that we can talk about in 1 second. So this could contribute, and some of my studies actually show that this trait level effects, like the individual baseline levels of sleep, REM sleep in this case that you have, might predispose you to, for example, process threatening experiences and in a non-optimal way. But also the sleep after these experiences, maybe as a result of these experiences, could be altered and contribute to problems later on. Mm-hmm. So it's both before and after. It also could be potentially a little too late if it happens after. So I love to focus on what you can do to prevent things rather than try to fix them later. So to respond to your question, what could you do if you don't feel that you sleep well enough? Well, so there are all kind of things with, I guess, some degree of usefulness. The concept of sleep hygiene is very common nowadays as the first frontiers, the first thing that you do before you go into more stronger interventions. And sleep hygiene relates to habits. For example, you try to go to sleep at certain hour, not too late, not too early, and you wake up, hopefully, at certain hours. And you try to use your bed only for sleeping and not to do any other activities. And you stop looking at your screen, whether it's a computer or your phone, at certain hour, and you're not exposing yourself to this light coming from the monitor after a certain hour. You don't drink coffee after, let's say, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Also important is to try and make your room as dark as possible and also as quiet as possible. Those things really help to maintain sleep. And there are several other things, so these kind of sleep habits that are could help you get the sleep that you need and also the REM sleep that you need related to what we mentioned. I do want to mention though one thing about it related to the keep things as quiet as possible. So some people like to sleep with a noise machine. It helps them. And it could potentially help falling asleep to some people. And there's studies, not necessarily in relation to REM sleep, but in relation to memory consolidation in general, that show that sleeping with a pink noise machine, for example, white noise, pink noise machine, could be helpful in reducing the amount of time that takes you in order to fall asleep and maintaining sleep, and there's might maybe even increase in the amplitude or power of the slow waves when you sleep with these devices. But a recent paper of mine that was just published 2 months ago actually show that it could also be detrimental to some things. So for example, when you need your creativity to or to have an insight in order to detect certain patterns, that it was shown years ago that sleep, and particularly slow sleep, might be helpful in waking up and having the solution, right? We all have mm-hmm. these experiences once in a while. We don't know how to solve something. We go to sleep, we wake up, and oh, we have a solution. But what I showed is that sleeping with pink noise could sometimes hurt you and not help you. And the reasons for that are not absolutely clear, but one reason is exactly because it helps you fall asleep quicker and potentially move directly to or move more quick or quicker to stages like N2 and N3 and skip another stage, which usually only comprise often like few minutes of sleep. It's called N1. That's the lightest sleep stage. And you would think that, okay, I don't need N1 that much. I'm just going back to the, going directly to the real business of sleep. But in fact, N1, this part, this light sleep that is sometimes considered to be like half awake, half sleep, or just the beginning of sleep, may present as a sweet spot in order for you to come up with ideas, right? You don't realize that, but it happens subconsciously and contributes to your ability to detect patterns. It's a theory, there's some evidence coming from other labs to it. And what I showed is that when you sleep with pink noise, that this N1 shortening is correlated to a decrease in your ability to come up with this idea and the detection of patterns that is important to solve certain tasks. So I would think that if you can sleep without any noise, that would be an advantage.
So scientists working on their grants at the last minute, staying up late, are definitely doing the wrong thing.
Absolutely.
Especially if they want to solve some critical problem.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Ikemura, it was great talking to you about this.
Yeah. Thank you
and,
very much.
This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.